Okay, fine. I just wanted to make a few more remarks. I think we were speaking, we were discussing the Timaeus, and we were discussing the fact that Plato understands the world to be a living creature with a soul and intelligence. I just wanted to mention actually a few things about that. I think it's a side point, but I think it's a very interesting side point. First of all, the Rambam devotes an entire chapter to this. I mean, we spoke about the Rambam's understanding, Plato's theory of forms. It also appears in the Rambam, right? It's Nachal B'Reis Ba'am. We spoke about that. But actually, that the actual world is a living being, which is actually, according to Timaeus, on page 16, guided by this reasoning, he put intelligence and soul and body, and so he constructed the universe. He wanted to produce a piece of work that would be as excellent as supreme as nature would allow. This, then, in keeping with our likely account, is how we must say divine providence brought our world to being as a truly living thing endowed with soul and intelligence. And then he goes on to say that that the world resembles more closely than anything else that living thing of which all other living things are parts, both individually and by kinds. The living thing that appears here in this translation is a capital L, a capital T. I'm not exactly sure. He uses a definite article. I'm not exactly sure that living thing. I'm not sure what that living thing refers to. Does it refer to a man? Does it refer to somebody else? However, what's interesting to note is that the Rambam develops, the Rambam devotes an entire chapter of the first chelik of the Meirat Nevuchim, Perak Ayin Beis, to this concept that in fact actually the world is actually parallel to a human being. The Rambam speaks about this, and the Rambam calls a man an Olam Katan. For example, it appears in the Schwartz edition from page 194 until page 203. I'll just quote from an important paragraph. On page 200 in the Schwartz edition, on the third paragraph, Da, she'omrim ala adam shu Olam Katan. You know that it says it's set upon man that he's a small world. Right? Not only is it because we compare the world to the parts of the world to the in other words, to a human being, right? And this speaks about it's interesting that the Rambam says is that it, in other words, because we compare it to an animal too, right? But the Rambam says we never heard of anyone saying that a donkey or chamor asus or a horse is an oilam katan. El shadava nema la adam rap beglal ha'inyan amyuchad la adam. But this is set upon a person because that which is unique to man, for what koach hamadaber. This is his power of speech. Da'ino haseichel. Which I guess, which says really man's intellect. That's the logos. Right? And et cetera, et cetera. So in fact, actually, the Rambam records Plato's view and subscribes to the fact that the world is actually, man is a small world, and the world is actually this creature, which is actually, corresponds in an analogy to man, and also the fact that it has a seichel, has intelligence. The Rambam is clearly getting this out of Plato's Timaeus. Now, this issue was very, very much picked up by the Mekubalim. The Nefesh HaChayim, did I mention Nefesh HaChayim last time? Spoke about the fact that in fact, actually, in Shah Bey's Parakei, that he wanted to claim that the Rambam actually is alluding to Kabbalistic things. And the Nefesh HaChaim has an entire, right? Basically, the Nefesh HaChaim understands that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the neshama of the world, in much the way that a person has a neshama too. But, and the v'chaim, right? In other words, this is a very, it's not really related so much to creation ex nihilo that we're speaking about, but the very, very fact is that the Rambam is ascribing to this platonic view of the world as being actually a living creature, which, by the way, is not only Plato's view, it's also Aristotle's view too. Aristotle also understood that the world was actually a living creature. The distinction between the Rambam and what I think to be is Plato is that Plato calls it the living thing, but he doesn't refer directly to man. Aristotle, I believe, actually, in fact, understood that that the world is actually similar to some type of an animal. In other words, much more biological. The Rambam understands that the Rambam understands that the analogy to May is to that of man, which is significant why the Rambam actually relates it to man. I would venture to say, without going into this in detail, that the distinction between the Rambam and Plato and Aristotle is that, you know, as far as the Rambam is concerned, man is much more of a central part of the entire world. In other words, we don't see in Plato, or certainly not in Aristotle, that man occupies, you know, any enough of a unique position. I mean, man does have intelligence, but also the world has intelligence too. Because we don't see in the Greek philosophers that man occupies this privileged position in the world. I mean, man is part of nature and part of a world which has intelligence in general. In Judaism, right, and the Bar Nevuchim is a Jewish book, certainly man is in fact actually created B'Tzelem Elokim, the image of God. That's the first chapter of the Bar Nevuchim. Man occupies a very, very privileged, unique, important part of the world. So even though man might be, you know, it's part of the physical world, his position is clearly unique, clearly important. In fact, he's created B'Tzelem Elokim. I mean, he's endowed with intellect, as we've seen, and the Rambam speaks about this in chapter 68, 69 of the first Chelek. He's endowed with intellect, which is actually, in a certain sense, completely analogous, at least an act to that of God, that of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So in other words, what the Rambam is doing here is that he's borrowing upon the cosmology, Greek cosmology, but in fact, actually, he's giving it a Jewish twist, namely that the essence of the world, as reflected in the analogy to man, right, is in particular to man, and is not a living creature. And I think this is a very, 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 very important point to make, that the Rambam is making a very important variation on a theme, a Greek theme, which discusses at length in chapter 72.
Schwartz in footnote 2 on page 194.
What?
Page 194.
Yeah.
In footnote 2.
Yeah.
He says, he brings down Timaeus and Aristotle. But
yeah.
He also says, this idea is an avastra of Inasan and Sefer Yetzirah.
This is what?
This idea of Olam Katan is also an avastra of Inasan and Sefer Yetzirah.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether that makes some Jewish ideas or whether, I'm not sure historically which comes first.
That's good. I think maybe we should look at it. We'll have to get a chance to look at it, but not, we'll have to look at not the Goyen's Perush and Sefer Yetzirah, but more maybe the Raivit or Avsajit or one of the Perushim of the Rishonim on Sefer Yetzirah to see exactly how they understand this. The fact is that the Nefesh HaChaim, the Nefesh HaChaim, this notion of Adam as being an Olam Katan is fundamental to the Nefesh HaChaim. There's no question about it. The whole concept of Tzelem Elokim in the Nefesh HaChaim is in fact actually an expression of that the world is one anthropomorphic face of which corresponds to man. So that's fundamental in the Kabbalah. It's interesting is that it's very interesting that Reb Chaim Volozhiner, I mean, you look the entire Rambam's Bar Nevuchim, there's no, I mean, I mean, people might call this or that mystical, but it's interesting that Chaim V'Lajana picked this up as being really where the Rambam is hinting at the secrets of the Kabbalah. And the Lashon of Chaim V'Lajana is the Roy Lemisha Oimron, and the Rambam is being Meramis to Kabbalah. We mentioned, I think, Reb Tzadik, that actually Greek philosophy is the chitzonius of the Panemius HaTorah.
Do you remember the Makor for that?
I forget, we have to find the Makor for that, yeah? Yeah. There is actually something which I think is worth mentioning too. I mean, if we're speaking already about this thing, for Aristotle, okay, for Plato maybe not, but for Aristotle, the world was all that there was. Okay, for Plato, we have these, theoretical, forms of which the world is a imperfect expression, but the Aristotle understood there's nothing but the world. We're going to see this in a little while, too, when we go to Aristotle's physics. In other words, the Greeks understood that the entirety of the universe, I think Plato and Aristotle understood, which was normative Greek science, that the entirety of the universe, that all there is the universe. In other words, they didn't recognize, Aristotle didn't recognize things like a vacuum, which is a concept of space, and time, too, we'll see in Aristotle, is actually, in fact, really motion. Time is identical with motion. In other words, the Greeks understood that the entire universe is all that there is. The universe is not contained in something else. This is Aristotle for certain, and even Plato too, to a certain extent. I mean, you have the form, but you can just include the forms as being part of the other universe. And this was actually a debate between these Greek philosophers and the Stoics. The Stoics, actually, we spoke about this. The Rambam speaks about the Kalam, who postulated that, in fact, actually there was something like vacuum, and also he spoke about the discreteness of time. In other words, there was holes in the universe, and that was basically Newtonian. That was actually Newtonian physics. Well, Newtonian physics, its conceptual breakaway from Greek physics, was in fact that introduced the fact that the universe is merely something that's contained within space, contained within time. So in other words, the Greeks actually did away with this notion of oilem katan. In other words, and because of that, in the 17th century, you have in the 17th century, interestingly enough, in the 17th century, you have the onset of what's called immanence. The philosophers in the 17th century, Malebranche, Descartes starts speaking about the body of God. Spinoza, in other words, God already begins to have a body. And part of the body of God is the fact is that you have these abstract notions like space and time, which don't actually refer to they're abstract. In other words, the world is contained within space, or contained within time. And since these concepts are abstract, they're not things that are contained in the world. They're purely abstract. So there was actually a notion of immanence, namely that we have here things which are really of a totally spiritual nature. They're certainly not of a physical nature. Space is an abstraction, time is an abstraction. And because of this, this lent itself to in the 17th and 18th century, in the Renaissance, then philosophers start speaking about the body of God. And I think I've mentioned in the Goyim Shulchan, but I think it's worthy of mentioning here, that the first notion of immanence, we'll leave the Nefesh HaChaim's interpretation of the Rambam on the side, but the first real immanence that we see in Jewish philosophy is in the Arizal. And the Arizal, in this Hakdama, speaks about the irreducible dichotomy between the Kodesh Baruch Hu and of himself, the Kodesh Baruch Hu's race of the world. Then, in fact, actually, there is a theology of immanence, which was picked up by the Bala Tanya almost literally, and that constituted the great debate between the Gaon and the Bala Tanya. The Bala Tanya. Now, what's interesting is that the So what's interesting is that this notion, though, of the world being a living creature is a theory of immanence in a certain sense. The way the Nefesh HaChayim learns in the Rambam, the Kadosh Baruch Hu is in fact actually like the neshama of the physical world. Now, that's a very shocking statement, because given what we know from the Nefesh HaChayim in Sha'al Gimel, that Mamala Kol Almam is something that's, in other words, removed from man's possible conception, that man relates to God transcendentally. That's his definition of Kav and Tzimtzum in Chelek Gimel. To say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is his essence, is the neshama, the physical world, that sounds, I don't want to use the word mamish, but sounds mamish like the Balatanya. If there's one or two places in the Nefesh HaChayim where the Nefesh HaChayim actually lets up and sounds like the Baal HaTanya. In my Nefesh HaChayim, I put this ha'or and I leave it b'tzoch in gadol, but the fact is that Reb Chaim Volozhin has forgotten himself, in a certain sense. I mean, and he speaks about the spiritual and the physical world too. His Lashon in Perakeh is El Yoinim V'Tachtoinim. So in other words, God's neshama permeates the physical world too.
That's what Rav Dessler says. There's no machlokas between them.
But that can't be. You see, in Sha'al Gimel, that's absurd. In Sha'al Gimel, he's coming to totally contend with the Nefesh HaChayim. In other words, with the Baal HaTanya. This is not sugya beduchte. In other words, in Sha'al Gimel, he is coming clearly to argue with the Baal HaTanya and saying you learned the Tzimtzum wrong and I'm going to revert them. That in fact, contraction, right, is... In other words, it's not a process of contraction and then emanation. Simpson and Cobb, rather two aspects, and that the what's called the malakol almim is something which is removed from man's possible conceptual field. I mean, that's sugi b'dochta. He's clearly arguing on the Baal HaTanya. There's no question about it. And also, I don't want to sound that from here, but it's inconceivable that he wouldn't argue Baal HaTanya, given the fact that his Rebbe, the Goyim, called the Baal HaTanya a paganist, a min, for saying things like this. It is true that he suggests a different solution, but it's inconceivable that he's not arguing about Baal HaTanya on this, right? But the fact is that here in Shabbos, Perakeh, he makes this statement, and I really clearly don't understand, where this fits in and to his overall hashkafa. I'm just leaving it to Tzarachiyon. This is a Tzarachiyon I can't answer. The fact is, though, is that this... In other words, the Rambam certainly, if Nefesh HaChayim's interpretation aside, the Rambam certainly did not understand this thing to be a question of immanence. He understood this just to be an analogy between man and the world. That's how I understand the Rambam. And even if he speaks about the fact that man is seichel, that just means that we can ascribe a certain seichel to the working of the world. But the Rambam didn't mean that the essence of Kodesh Baruch Hu itself, right, is within the world. But in other words, but in any case, right? And the fact is that the immanence really comes about really with the Ari. There's actually a claim that the notion of immanence appears in the Ramban. I think one of the professors wants to say like that. But in any case, real immanence comes with the Ari. The fact is that the Baal HaTanya's, but this fits very well with the Baal HaTanya. The Baal HaTanya, in other words. The Baal HaTanya's understanding of God's immanence in the world is very, very much similar to this. And what's interesting is, you see, in terms of Newton, in other words, it's not that God's soul permeates the world. It's just a certain parameters, like geometry and space and time represent somehow spiritual parameters, but the world itself is opaque. But in fact, this theory that the world has a soul, right, this is an extreme notion of immanence, and this actually, I'm sure this is what Tzaddik meant. Tzaddik is one of the great immanents in history, if you look at his writings. I mean, everything's a Kadosh Baruch Hu. So Tzaddik says that the Greek philosophy is the chitzonius of Kabbalah. I think he means precisely this. Greek philosophy basically creates a completely immanental aspect an immanental picture of the world, which in fact actually is right up with Tzaddik in the Balatanya's alley. Okay, in any case, I just wanted, I don't want to, this is not a Shirat Kabbalah, but I just wanted to go through this. It's well worth noting this thing. Maybe let's speak about Einstein and space-time. Since I'm speaking about science on a tangent, maybe just continue on a tangent. What was the revolution of Einstein? The revolution of Einstein was that time is no longer, and geometry too, in space. The revolution of Einstein was basically to put time and space back into the physical world. In other words, what Einstein did is he made space and time physical things. In other words, in Newton, they were abstract things not connected with the world. What Einstein did was, in fact, actually to put space and time back in the world. I think we spoke about this in the first class. If not, in any case, Einstein's contribution was that time and space constitute the world in front of us. There's no abstract time independent of the world. There's no space independent of the world. Now, so really the revolution of Einstein in the beginning of the 20th century with general relativity was to restore this Aristotelian Platonic vision or scientific understanding of the world. Now, of course, this always has one of two consequences. I mean, like anything is. I mean, if you don't believe that God's soul permeates the world, which I don't think Einstein believed, so either that could lead you to saying that the structure of the world is God itself, and that was Einstein's statement that his God is the God of Spinoza, because you have nothing but the world, all there is the world, or you have to be much more optimistic like people like Rav Kook were, and Rav Kook always claimed that new scientific discoveries just push forward our concept of monotheism, which means now that time and space have been allocated or relegated to physical quantities and not spiritual abstract notions, then already our concept, our monotheistic concept of God has to actually become much higher and higher. That's what Cook claimed, and those are really the two options that the modern man has. Okay, fine. Anyway, like I said before, I've said this a few times, I'm going to go off on tangents. It's interesting things to think about, but I want to go for it now. I think basically we've concluded more or less with the sources of the Rambam in dealing with the Platonic theory. Now what about Aristotle? Now in fact actually is that Aristotle argues with Plato. Right? And his argument with Plato and of course Aristotle believed, is that the Rambam claims, I want to go to page 299, that Plato believes that the Shemayim was created, it was created, and what I want to do is I want to read from Aristotle's Physics, and here in Aristotle's Physics, he actually attributes to Plato even more than the Rambam attributes to Plato. Now, I have here, I understand, a very good translation of Aristotle's Physics. It has the Haskama of, what's his name in the library? I forget his name. But there's someone there, a Frum guy with Peyus, who's a Mulch in Greek, and he's Maskim. This guy is a very good translation. This translation of Aristotle, and what I did was I Xeroxed from Book 8 of the Physics. In Book 8 of the Physics, Aristotle actually speaks about the eternality of motion. Now, I have not really found any, at least, I haven't found any place where Aristotle actually speaks about, you know, creation itself, per se. And, you know, he doesn't devote that much to creation, per se, and an argument with Plato. But here and there, there's different places where he does refer to Plato. Now, in Book 8, which is in this volume, this is the collected works of Aristotle, it begins on page 418, and Aristotle is trying to prove that motion has to be eternal. In other words, the motion cannot have been started at any point in time. Now, if you turn the page to page 420, there, beginning in line 11, So it's line 11 on page 420, and I understand that there's some other page numbers on the side, so it gets 251B. Interesting, Amudim. 251B, maybe it refers to the initial physics of Aristotle. And it's in parentheses, and Aristotle's making a motion, right? Aristotle's making an argument that motion has to be eternal, right? And line 5. So he says, so if the motion was not always in process, it's clear that there could not have been the conditions such to render them capable of respectively being moved and causing motion. In other words, motion, anything which moves, has to always have been in motion. Now, he says in the parentheses on line 11, furthermore, he says, how could there be any before and after the existence of time? It's interesting. He's going to make now an interesting argument. It's obviously it's not the main argument he makes, but it's a very interesting argument, because here he mentions Plato. He says, how could there be, in other words, Aristotle identified time with motion. What? So he says something like this. If you want to say there was something before things were in motion, right? So you have to say there was a period of history where there was time and no motion. But that can't be, because time is dependent upon motion, as it says. How can there be anything before and after the existence of time? Without the existence of time, in other words, you can't have something without the existence of time. Or how can there be any time that exists as motion? In other words, you can't have something existing without time, but you can't have time without motion. If then time is the number of motion or itself a kind of motion, it follows that if there was always time, the motion must be eternal. In other words, if I could prove to you, says Aristotle, that there always was time, then there always had to be motion, because time only comes from motion. But so far as time is concerned, we see that all with one exception are in agreement, that it is uncreated. Everybody agrees you can't create time. In fact, it's just this that enables Democritus to show that all things cannot have had a beginning. Democritus held that things could not have a beginning, what's his raya? Because you can't create time. And because of this, things could not have had a beginning. Because if they had a beginning, then there was a time, then you're saying that time is created. For time, he says, is uncreated. In other words, time by definition is uncreated. Plato alone. Now, here he brings Plato. Okay? Now, Aristotle read Plato in the Greek. So, you know, he's a Baal Samcha here. If he brings Plato, it means he read him or he had a Messiah of what Plato was saying. Plato alone asserts the creation of time. Interesting. Plato asserts the creation of time, saying that it is simultaneous with the world, that the world came into being. Very interesting. What's Aristotle saying? Aristotle is making Plato into a Flamingid. That Plato held, Aristotle seems to be saying that Plato is saying the world came into being. Is that creation ex nihilo? That seems to certainly be a direct contradiction to what Plato said in the Timaeus on page 15. That a God brought the world from a state of disorder to one of order. And that's certainly against what the Rambam is saying with Plato. But he says like this, grill me. Now, since time cannot exist, and is unthinkable apart from the now, in other words, the only time, and the now is a kind of middle point, uniting as it does in itself both a beginning and an end, a beginning of future time and an end of past time. It follows that there must always be time. For the extremity of the last period of time that we take must be found in some now, since in time we can't take nothing but nows. Therefore, since the now is both a beginning and an end, there must always be time on both sides of it. But if this is true of time, it is evident that it must also be true of motion, time being a kind of perfection of motion. Now, first of all, I would like to just be marked in this a very interesting thing. In the Megillah Levuchim, the Rambam speaks about Bereshis Bar Lokim, the Kodesh Baruch Hu created the world ex nihilo. Then, what does it mean? That Kodesh Baruch Hu, so what's Bereshis Bar Lokim? So it's mashed from the Rambam. The Rambam has learned that Kodesh Baruch Hu created the world with Reishis. with the Reishas. This is Mashma in the Perek Lamed. Now, in the traditional Mefarshim, there's a Machloikas. What is this Reishas with which the Rabbim created the world? And the Shem Tov understands that Reishas basically means the Machshav HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's really the way the Rambam learns on Peter Zaya, that with Reishas, Bereishas means with Chachma HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. However, Kreskas, who's, by the way, Derech Agav is a very great anti-Aristotelian, claims that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world with called Atta. In other words, the Metzias, the existence of time, is all in the present, right? Obviously, because the past doesn't exist, the future has not come about. So the reality of time is the present. Now, says Aristotle that you cannot say that a Kadosh Baruch Hu created the world at some time. Why not? Because if he created the world at some time, that means at the time that he created the world, that was at that time a present time. Christus calls that Atta. He created the world at a certain time. Well, every present has a past and a future. In other words, what's the present if not the dividing point between the past and the future? So, you can't say that God created the world at any specific time. Because if he created the world at a specific time, then you would have to create, in other words, there would have to be a present moment, which Kreskos calls Atta, and which he created the world. Every present moment, by definition, has to have a past and a future. So if there was a time before the creation of time, that's, of course, a paradox. And therefore, Aristotle argues that HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot have created time. A few weeks ago, I was trying to make an argument to a bunch of Bachram from Chavon Yeshiva. They were having a little bit of difficulty with that argument. I was a little bit surprised and taken aback that the Chavon Yeshiva Bachram can't follow the simple argument of Aristotle. But in any case, what's interesting is that this is Aristotle's argument against Plato. In other words, if in fact time cannot be created and time is dependent upon motion, then motion is eternal. If motion is eternal, then in fact the world was never created. The world has just been moving all the time. Now, the fact is, which I want to say is that how is Aristotle understanding Plato? Because Plato says explicitly, right, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world from a state of disorder. He created it from a state of disorder, he says explicitly. I mean, how could Aristotle say that it's created? So, I mean, B'daychak, I don't know if we're supposed to be miyasha these things like miyasha of a Gemara. It could possibly be that Plato's hiyuli is basically a notion. It doesn't have, in other words, it doesn't have time or motion. Hiyuli means something which is sort of like undefinable, toyo bavoyo, that the Ramban learns. And it doesn't have a property of time. Well, let's put it in the Greek way. If time is dependent upon motion, then it certainly doesn't have motion. Because it has motion, and already it's physically definable. So in other words, what I'm saying is the following thing is that Aristotle is not, you know, claiming that Plato understood the world was created ex nihilo, but in other words, for Aristotle, time is not really an abstract concept. Time is really a derivative of motion. Plato's state of disorder could not have had motion, because once it has motion, it has order. And because of that, it could not have had time. And therefore, says Aristotle, how could Plato claim that time was created? So in other words, I don't have to make the argument of Aristotle necessarily. He attributes to Plato creation ex nihilo. The other thing is I want to just make one comment, if I nia ani in this thing, is that I claim that Aristotle speaks from two sides of his mouth. I'll tell you why. Because the argument that Aristotle makes is not an argument about time as a property of motion. In other words, Aristotle's treating time as a very abstract concept. In other words, Aristotle's argument is really a bluff, because he's treating time as an abstract concept. And by treating time as an abstract concept, he says, well, you see, time cannot have been created. And since time cannot have been created, and time comes from motion, there must have been eternal motion. Is eternal motion, then there can't be a state of disorder. That's Aristotle's argument. But really, Aristotle is wrong in this argument. Why? Because Aristotle's argument only works on a conceptual, abstract concept of time. The real time, as a property of motion, could very well have been created, just like motion could be created. But I don't see that Aristotle's argument really works so well. But in any case, Aristotle believes that, in fact, actually, that motion is eternal. And for this reason, he rejects the fact that the world could have been created from any set of disorder. Now, since in Aristotle, motion represents the most primordial form of the physical world, because it's what motion that sets the world what actually sets everything into existence and it determines the physics of the entire world. So because of that, since the motion is eternal, so the world cannot have been in a disordered state, because it's motion which actually, the motion of the spheres, which actually provides the basis of the physical qualities of the world. And so because of that, everything has remained the same. There isn't a notion of from disorder to order. That's Aristotle's point. Now, I want to, the final point I want to make here is that really, this book 8 of Aristotle is really a proof of the existence of God. In fact, actually, it's clear, it's evident, that the Rambam in the first chapter of the second volume of Bar Nevuchim derived this proof of God, of the existence of God and of God's incorporeality from Aristotle. Now, actually, Aristotle makes a lot of arguments about this, but in fact, actually, if I can just go to the very end of Aristotle's arguments, and that's on page 446. It's the very, very last page here. It corresponds to the original Aristotelian pages of 267b. That's Daf Reish Samach Zayin Amud Beis. And I just want to read the final paragraph here. Now that these points are settled, it is clear that the first unmovement cannot have any magnitude. For if it has magnitude, there must be either a finite or an infinite magnitude. Now we have already proved in our course in physics that there cannot be an infinite magnitude. And we've now proved that it's impossible for a finite mode to have an infinite force, and also that it's impossible for a thing to be moved by a finite magnitude during an infinite time. But the first mover causes a motion that is eternal and causes it without during an infinite time. It's clear, therefore, that it's an indivisible as without parts and without magnitude. Basically, what Aristotle is saying is what the Rambam says in the first parak of the second chelek of the Moreh Nevuchim. The Rambam's proof of the existence of God, right, is actually, and from page, beginning from page 258, the Schwartz edition, to 262, the Rambam actually adopts the Aristotelian proof of God based upon the same concept. In fact, where does the eternity of the world come in the Rambam's proof of God? By the way, Derech Agav, the Rambam actually lists this. On page 256 of the Hagdama, in the Schwartz edition, the Rambam says he lists axiom number 26, Gematria Yudke Vavke, to be Kadmas Ha'olam. Why Kadmas Ha'olam? It's because it's very clear. Because Plato says that that if God is of a right, is bound in a finite magnitude, how can God have moved for an infinite amount of time? So it must be God cannot be of any finite magnitude. Now, in fact, actually, this is the Rambam's proof, right? On page 260, the Rambam says in the second paragraph, right? I'm reading for the Schwartz edition. The Hainu, Shemania Galgal Koyach Mispashit Boy, Gami Bilti Efshari. In other words, if there's a force, Gagal Guf, Lefichu Behech Soifi, it has to be bounded. Lechain Koyach Soifi. In other words, if the first mover is bounded, therefore its force has to be bounded. But says the Rambam, however, the Ein Mania Ad Ein Sof, but it can't be eternal. But that's true. How can it be moving eternally? This is the same. This is word for word from Aristotle. Word for word from Aristotle. So, and this is one of, obviously, one of the great paradoxes of the Morning of Ochem. And the Rambam, in this chapter, the Rambam is coming to, you know, argue, to deny, or to oppose the tyranny of the world. In fact, his proof of the existence and of the incorporeality of God rests upon the same argument that Aristotle makes, right? And which is very, very much based upon the eternity of motion, the eternity of the world. That's what the Rambam admits the fact. Okay, in any case, there is certainly no mention of this here in the Moed of Uchim and Parak Yud Gimel. This is a paradox which we'll have to deal with. The Rambam though mentions something very interesting. He says, is that one would think, what? Page 300. One would think that the argument to believe in for Aristotle, in Aristotle's theory, is because it allows me to believe that God is incorporeal. But that's not what the Rambam is going to say. It says, right? It's impossible. In other words, it's impossible that a Kodesh Baruch Hu should have a rotzoi which he doesn't have already. Which also, we'll have to speak about that too, because the fact is that Rambam has argued in many places in Chelek Gimel, there can't be Mishkadosh Yediyah in God. There can't be something, according to Rambam, God has a knowledge of something at one time, not before that. That's a chisaron in a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So that's something we're going to have to deal with too. In any case, right, without even going into the real stevas in the Morning of Uchim, it comes out, a very interesting thing is, the Platonic concept of the creation of the world was adopted by the Rambam, both in the notion of the theory of forms we spoke about, and also in the fact that the world is a living creature, a living body. And the Aristotelian argument for the eternity of motion was adopted by the Rambam in his proof of existence and incorporeality of God. So the Rambam did make use of these two theories in other parts of the Moed HaNevuchim.
Even though the Tarsus actually.
Right. Now, I want to conclude a little bit with Perek Yud Gimel. The Rambam says there are certain views he doesn't discuss. Who does he discuss? He's not going to discuss the apikosim, or people who don't believe in God. And that's what the Rambam says. This is a summary of the views and their truth. Says the Rambam, these are the opinions of those people who believe in God. But if you don't believe in God, he's not going to give you a pin. Like he says in the next line. Those who don't acknowledge the existence of God, people think that things happen just by chance. No one, there's no designer. As Epicurus. Alexander has recorded. There's no point in mentioning these things. Why not? Because you're not Bikayat. No, says the Rambam. We've already proven that the world was created. How do we prove that? Using the eternity of the world of Aristotle. Now, by the way, Maimonides has other proofs too. Let's think about that. I'm well aware of the fact that Maimonides also makes a type of ontological argument. And I saw, actually, someone argue that since Maimonides makes another argument, so this is not necessarily a stira, a contradiction. I disagree with that, but I don't want to go into it right now. But let me tell you something. I mean, if you can make an argument that's not a stira, why would you make an argument that's a stira? Makes absolutely no sense. Okay? The person who wrote that, I basically lost all my respect for him. He wrote a book on Maimonides. I've lost respect for him for other ways too, but that really was the Makom HaPatish. Now, so the Rambam says, I'm not going to mention people who deny this is of God. Why? Because it's been proven. Says the Rambam, these people are not logical. How could you discuss an opinion that's the opposite of thing that's been proven? Right? The Rambam, I'm not going to try to prove. Right? I'm not going to try to prove those who believe in the second opinion, that was Platonic eternity. Because says the Rambam, according to our sheet, there's no distinction between a person who believes like Plato and Aristotle. Because the purpose of our Shari Matar Shal HaOlchemik was Moshe Rabbeinu, Avraham Avinu, is that God created the world, creation ex nihilo. How can the Rambam say like this? The Rambam is saying, I'm not going to try to prove the opinion of Plato. There's no difference between Plato and Aristotle. Meaning the Rambam is certainly not going to try to prove Aristotle. Because who cares? They both believe in the eternity of the universe. And our sheet is the world created ex nihilo. How can the Rambam say that? The Rambam says in Chelek Beis Perek Chafei that if a person wanted to believe in Plato's theory of the eternity of the universe, that's fine. He could believe in Nisim. He could believe in the Mechil of Klal Yisrael. In other words, you haven't undermined the foundations of the Torah. But says the Rambam, Aristotle undermines the foundations of the Torah. So how could you possibly say there's no distinction between Aristotle and Plato? It's an incredible distinction. On the contrary, right? In Kilo there's a concept that you prove something less because the person might become an apikoros, whatever it is. Let's assume there's a concept like that. Today, that's not true anymore. Today, we don't go like that. But let's assume, in other words, why not prove that Plato is true just that so may ah? So you won't believe in Aristotle. How could the Rambam equate the two opinions? Unless you want to say that the Rambam want to say is, I'm not going to bother proving them. In other words, if you want to believe in Plato, fine. But I'm not going to bother proving it because there's no point in proving it that I would believe anyway. Not to mention that in fact, the Rambam never proves Briyei Shemayim. As we'll see, it's Hashem. The Rambam just proves the other ones haven't been proven. Which leads me to another question. What do you mean, I'm not going to bother proving it? The other ones haven't been proven. Also, too, why does the Rambam say, I'm not going to bother proving the second opinion? Because I'll do it between the second opinion and Aristotle. So, in other words, to look at it in a Lundish way, the Rambam's Havamina was to prove Plato and not Aristotle. Why did he choose to prove Plato? I mean, before I declare my yesod that Plato's better than Aristotle. So you have to say, you could say, is that the Rambam has in the back of his mind that, if I believe in Plato, that corresponds to the Torah. Let me prove Plato. At least no one will be a kaifa. So the Rambam says, I could prove Plato, but what's the point in it? If you're already choosing what to believe in, you might as well believe in the theory of Moshe Rabbeinu and Avraham Avinu, the world created ex nihilo. It's a very difficult passage in the Rambam. Clearly, the Rambam is getting at something. What he's getting at is not going to be clear now. Yirtzeh Hashem will speak about this. But clearly, the Rambam is getting at something. Both shittas, though, nonetheless ascertain that the world's eternal in contradiction to this. Okay, now, let me just say a few minutes of where we're holding, where we're going. The Rambam says in the last line, page 301, the last line in Perek Yud Gimel, Lashik Avadas Hadeus, after we've established his opinions, Askil Lahavir Lasakim is Rai Yosef, shall Aristotle Ladaitahu, Umar Laskach. In other words, it's going to clarify the opinions of Aristotle and what was Ma'irahim, what led Aristotle to have his opinions. Now, first of all, the Rambam does not go very much into Platonic theory. The attack appears to be on Aristotle, which could lead a person to the assumption or to the hypothesis that the Rambam was leaving things open. Perhaps I believe in Plato. Like Rambam says in chapter 25, there's no inherent contradiction to the Torah, at least to any of the fundamental principles of the Torah. However, I think there's another important point here that he made too. The Rambam mentions here, the Rambam says, what does the Rambam say? The Rambam doesn't say, I'm going to prove creation ex nihilo. Doesn't say I'm going to prove creation ex nihilo. He says, right, that basically I have to, right, what's entailed here is that it's not an absurdity to speak about creation ex nihilo. In other words, the Rambam doesn't declare I'm going to prove creation ex nihilo. The Rambam is clearly saying, and this is going to be clear in the next few prokem, I'm going to prove to you that, I'm going to try to prove to you at least, or put it this way, to believe in creation ex nihilo, then it's essential to believe that it's not a paradox, a logical impossibility. And in fact, that's what the Rambam is going to do. What the Rambam is going to do next prokim is going to show that Aristotle has not thoroughly proven the world's eternal. And he's going to muster arguments that therefore creates things nihilo remains a possibility. It's not, in other words, it's not a paradox. It's not an illogical impossibility. In other words, really, the Rambam has said to us that, in fact, in other words, I just have to establish that Aristotle is not what you call mochach. In other words, it's logically necessary, not natural necessity, and that it's possible that creation ex nihilo is a possibility.
Permission to believe.
Right. Which is interesting. No, which is interesting. No, is that permission late? He tries to prove it. He claims he's proving it.
It's exactly that. Showing it's not illogical.
What?
He claims to show it's not illogical.
Why is it not illogical? Well, I don't go right into not illogical. I think my opinion is he seems to prove that it's very, very mistaken. It's very, very... I think permission to believe, that's the translation. But I think he tries to actually say that not only is it not illogical...